Isaiah chapter 3, the fourth talk in a series on the book of Isaiah, was presented by David Crabtree on March 25, 2012 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We'll be continuing in Isaiah. We'll be looking at chapter 3 today. We're just a couple chapters into the book, but as you can already see, it makes a big difference how you connect the ideas as they're presented in Isaiah. He very quickly moves from one idea to the next, and he will even recycle those ideas, and we'll see that that continues. It's a process where he'll keep coming back to ideas that he's already mentioned, and he'll elaborate on those and develop those even further. But the reader is left with the task of trying to connect and figure out how the ideas connect. We in our culture are more used to a kind of presentation where you have the ideas, words that relate the ideas, because, or for example, or an addition to that, or those kinds of phrases help you to know how the different parts connect. In Isaiah, that's not the style that's being used. There's one idea, then another idea, then another idea, and you have to figure out how they relate one to the other. That's the task of the interpreter. And clearly, it's going to make a big difference how you tie those ideas together. And I'm tying them together in a certain way. It's your job to check up on me, but I am tying them together in a certain way, and I think that he's developing a certain set of themes. One example of a difference is the last verse of chapter 2. In the last verse of chapter 2, it says, stop regarding man whose breath of life is in his nostrils, for why should he be esteemed? One commentary that I looked at was connecting this verse with what comes up. It's talking about the leadership of Israel being taken away. And the point that he thought was being made is there was too much reliance being given to the leadership of Israel, the human beings that were providing leadership for Israel. But if you'll recall last week, I'm tying it back to the things that the land is filled with that are listed in chapter 2, verses 6 through 8. And I have made the argument that all of those things that the land is filled with are human or human institutions that the Israelites have come to put their trust in. And that is what that's what Isaiah is warning against. So it makes a big difference how you connect the ideas as they come along. And I'm connecting them in a certain way. It's your job to keep track of me. The way that I'm connecting the dots so far, and we'll go back just to review what's in chapter 2. At the beginning of the chapter, it pointed out that Judah has a glorious future ahead of it. The time is coming in the last days when Jerusalem is going to be the capital of the world. And people are going to stream to it or flow up to it from all over the world. And the reason that they will flow up to it is because they desire greatly to get the instruction of the Lord, to understand God's truth. That's their primary motivation. And they will go there to have their conflicts resolved by God. So the picture of the future of Jerusalem is a phenomenal picture. It's a glorious future that awaits them. So, Isaiah says, live in accordance with that future that's coming. Live in a way that's fitting for the future that's coming. But you have not been. And as a result, God is coming in judgment. In particular, the case that he makes is that, and this goes back to chapter 1, that the people of Israel, the people of Judah, have refused to recognize and acknowledge the care and provision that God has provided for them. God is constantly caring and providing for them. In their history, they have many instances of that, some very dramatic instances in which God has cared for the people of Israel. But despite the record, the people of Israel don't recognize the one who has cared for them and provided for them. As a result, the people of Israel have looked for other ways by which their needs can be met. And that has been the impetus towards, and I'll use the term idolatry. I'm using that in a broad sense, and we'll talk about that more later. Exhibit one for God that demonstrates that the people of Israel have departed from him and are looking out for their own needs is the fact that widows and orphans in their midst are not only not cared for, but they're taken advantage of. Why does that come about? It's because the people of Israel are looking towards wealth as one of those things that can provide them with the security that they want. So that's just exhibit A for God, for Isaiah in his presentation. Then looking back at chapter 2, he points out there are four things that the land is filled with that have all become the kind of things that the people of Israel are trusting in. The first is superstition and divination from the east. The second is money. The third is military power. The fourth is idols, which your hands have made. So all four of these, I think it's being indicated, that all four of these are of human construction. They are all of human origin. They have all been made by human beings. And yet, even though these are things that are of the creation of creatures, the people of Israel refuse to acknowledge the Creator, the genuine, the true Creator of everything. Therefore, a judgment is coming. And in that judgment, three things will happen. One is the idols will be shown to be powerless. People will be scurrying for safety and security, and their idols will be to no avail in helping them. The second is that God will be exalted, be shown for who he is. And the third is that at the same time, man will be humbled. Man will be put in his proper place. So those are the things that will be accomplished in this day of judgment that is coming. So in taking my cues from what I understand Isaiah to be saying, I'm going to be using the term idolatry in a very broad sense. And even more, Isaiah uses the word, but I'm using it in a broader sense than he uses that word for. But I think he has this concept in mind. And that is, idolatry is when we trust something other than God for our ultimate care and provision. And what we need to do as human beings is to learn how, this is our place in life, to learn how to trust God rightly by his definition rather than by our definition. Okay. This week I received an email question. Let me read it to you and then I'll comment on it. Can the Bible be an idol? My comment and observation. Possibly when the Bible is taken out of context and makes something into a regular tradition or exercise that of a denomination or non-denomination would have a person line up with. Let me give examples. First one, physician, heal thyself. Second one, do this in memory of me. Third, faith without works is dead. Fourth, but I do not allow a woman to teach or exercise authority over a man. Fifth, for if a woman does not cover her head, let her also have her hair cut off. Some of these might seem extreme, but some churches still have a thing about making sure scriptures are upheld, almost as laws. Okay, that's the end of the email. And my response is, if I'm understanding what Isaiah is saying, if I'm understanding that correctly, and if I understand the concept that he is talking about, I think, yes, absolutely, the Bible could become an idol. In fact, anything could become an idol. I would go so far as to say, and you need to understand me rightly, God could become an idol. That is to say, if our conception of God is other than the God who is there, and if we are putting our trust in our conception of God that's different from the God that is there, then that can become an idol. Anything could become an idol. As I'm understanding this, the way we need to think about it is we are the servants, God is the master. We need to keep that really straight in our minds. And that means that our job is to figure out who he is, what he's up to, and how he wants us to relate to him. And work at doing that rightly, doing that the way that he wants it to be done. Idolatry is a rejection of that role. The servant's heart says, if God provides it, I need it. The rebel says, if I want it, I need it. And it's an inversion of the proper relationship. The rebel is taking the top position and dictating to God what God should be doing. The servant is content to allow the loving God who is there to act as he's going to act, to provide as he's going to provide. Because he is a loving God, he will provide for those things that we need. And he knows that better than we do. That understanding then of idolatry makes sense of the last chapter in that one of the emphases of that last chapter is that man is going to be humbled. That's exactly what we need. That we need to understand that we are in the subservient position to God in all things. We take our cues from him. We are his servant, not the other way around. It's really important that we understand that he's the creator. We are just creatures. Okay. Coming back to the question, could the Bible become an idol? Absolutely. I think that's true. I believe that the Bible is inspired and inerrant. And as I've studied the Bible over the years, I've grown more confident in that commitment. But I have been surprised as I've thought about passages, that my understanding of what it means for a passage to be inerrant and to be inspired has been tweaked a bit. And there are positions that I would hold now that I think probably 30 years ago I would have said were heretical, were blasphemous, that weakened the perspective of inerrancy. But I think I'm just making the adjustments that the text requires. And my perspective is, I don't want to presuppose what the Bible is. I don't want to dictate what the Bible is and how it should relate to me. My job is to figure out what God did put in front of us and relate to it correctly and understand it correctly. Now, in saying that, I know that it's possible for someone to say, if we have to figure out what the Bible is, there are all kinds of things that we could come up with. And some of those would be attractive in that they impinge less on our lives. I understand that completely. But I think there's no way around it. The Bible is what God made it to be, and our job is to figure out what that is and accept it as he intended it to be accepted. And to try to lay down a doctrine that is very rigid with respect to inerrancy and infallibility, to try to protect that, is just going to turn it into something that it is not. And it's only the rebellious heart that will take that latitude in the need to discover what it is and go in a direction with it that is not intended. That's my perspective. We can talk about this more afterwards in the comments and questions if you'd like to. Okay, chapter 3. What's going to happen in chapter 3 now is God's response to the rebelliousness of Israel. Let's look at the four verses. For behold, the Lord God of hosts is going to remove from Jerusalem and Judah both supply and support, the whole supply of bread and the whole supply of water. The mighty man and the warrior, the judge and the prophet, the diviner and the elder, the captain of 50 and the honorable man, the counselor and the expert artisan, and the skillful enchanter. And I will make mere lads their princes, and capricious children will rule over them. One more verse. And the people will be oppressed, each by one another, and each one by his neighbor. The youth will storm against the elder, and the inferior against the honorable. So God's response to the rebelliousness in Israel is that he is going to take away their care and protection. He's going to take away their support and their staff. He's going to take all of that away that they have been receiving from God over a long period of time, but they have taken it for granted. And they have turned to idols to provide their protection and their security. And God is going to demonstrate that those idols can't do it. So he's withdrawing the support and care that he has provided in the past. And that's going to include food and water. Food and water will run out on Jerusalem. Then it talks about something that's particularly easy, I think, to take for granted, and that is civic order, just kind of order in society and leadership. Those are things that God provides, and those are things that God can take away. So it seems to be describing a situation in which Jerusalem is deprived of water and food. A situation of crisis occurs, and there is no leadership. For some reason, there's no leadership to help them to cope with their difficult circumstances. He's going to take away all kinds of leadership. The mighty man and the warrior. So it's the mighty man here is a champion in war. And I think the warrior is probably like a commander, the judge and the prophet, the diviner. So we have in this list things that are illegitimate forms of leadership and guidance that the people of Israel have appealed to, as well as legitimate. A diviner and the elder, captain of 50, that seems to be a position in the city administration. And the honorable man, I'm not sure what, I don't know if that's an official position or that's just someone who is indeed honorable. The counselor and the expert artisan and the skillful enchanter. So there's another enchanter and diviner seem to be illegitimate forms of leadership. The others are legitimate forms of leadership. But it's all kinds. God's going to remove all of those. In their place, in this time of crisis, who will step in? What's going to fill the vacuum? It's going to be filled by mere lads, capricious children, who will then rule over them. And it says, and the people will be oppressed, each one by another and each one by his neighbor. So we have a breakdown of the order completely. There's a lack of leadership. What leadership is there is capricious. It isn't providing the kind of leadership that can give stability to a society. And people turn one against the other. Interestingly, it also says the youth will storm against the elder and the inferior against the honorable. That's the kind of thing that could happen in a society at any time. It's by the grace of God that it doesn't. And yet, in these circumstances, that's what's going to happen. So he gives a little scenario then of the kind of predicament that Jerusalem is in verses 6 and 7. When a man lays hold of his brother in his father's house, saying, you have a cloak, you shall be our ruler, and these ruins will be under your charge. On that day will he protest, saying, I will not be your healer, for in my house there is neither bread nor cloak. You should not appoint me ruler of the people. So we have a little scenario that shows how bad things have become. And they have become so bad that a man is approached who is living in his father's house. So he doesn't have an independent household. He apparently is still under the protection of his father. And because he has a cloak, because he has an outer garment, they're appealing to him to be the ruler. And what will he rule over? He will rule over the ruins of Jerusalem. Jerusalem is in ruins. He will be the ruler over that pile of rubble. So people are desperate for leadership, and just having a coat is enough distinction to warrant being asked to be their ruler. But he will protest, saying, I will not be your healer. He doesn't want the job. And I'm not sure exactly the thinking why he wouldn't want the job. Could be because it's just troubles. They're probably insolvable problems. And he doesn't want to be put in the position where he's expected to solve them. It could also be that he doesn't want to be the ruler when Jerusalem falls. And presumably there's an enemy just outside the gates that would be interested in talking to the ruler. In any case, he declines and says, I decline, and in any case, there's no bread or even a cloak in my house. I don't have what you thought I had that made me distinctive. So you should not appoint me ruler of the people. So you can see the complete desperation they have for someone to take charge, establish order in this critical situation. Going on. For Jerusalem has stumbled and Judah has fallen, because their speech and their actions are against the Lord, to rebel against his glorious presence. The expression of their faces bears witness against them, and they display their sin like Sodom. They do not even conceal it. Woe to them, for they have brought evil on themselves. Say to the righteous that it will go well with them, for they will eat the fruit of their actions. Woe to the wicked, it will go badly with them, for what he deserves will be done to him. O my people, their oppressors are children, and women rule over them. O my people, those who guide you lead you astray and confuse the direction of your paths. Why is God taking away all their care and provision? It's because of their rebelliousness. Jerusalem has stumbled and Judah has fallen. By everything that they do, both in actions and speech, their actions betray a rebelliousness against God. The expressions on their faces display that kind of rebelliousness. It says they display their sin like Sodom. We've seen that two other times when Isaiah has likened the wickedness of Israel to the wickedness of Sodom and Gomorrah. This is the third time. It says they do not even conceal it. So it's a wickedness that's all pervasive in absolutely everything. And as I've argued before, my suspicion is that it's not an outrageous evil. It's not blatantly wrong things that they're doing, but it's a kind of rebelliousness of heart. The reason I think that's the case is because Isaiah is arguing this in a way that suggests that they can't see it, but they should be able to see it. So I think it's not blatant kinds of evil. It's more subtle. So that's why this judgment is going to come, and this is why evil will be brought upon them. But for the righteous, it will go well. They're going to get what they deserve. For the wicked, it will go poorly. They will also get what they deserve. This is the second time we've seen that kind of couplet. It was used also in chapter 1, verses 27 and 28. Where it suggested that there would be an individual kind of judgment, where people would be treated according to their works. Then verse 12, O my people, their oppressors are children, and women rule over them. I'm not sure exactly what this is referring to. It could be referring historically to the fact that one of their kings, one of their worser kings, was Ahab, and he came to power when he was young. It was his mother that was really the power behind the throne. So this could be very specifically referring to that situation. Or it could be speaking more generally that their rulers have been like children, have been capricious, like children, and women rule over them. I'm not sure what that would connote if this is being used symbolically. It could be referring to a weakness, but in this case it would be a weakness of authority and rule is what it would be likening to, but I'm not sure. In any case, their leaders have been leading them astray and confusing the direction of their paths. Verse 13 through 15. The Lord arises to contend and stands to judge the people. The Lord enters into judgment with the elders and princes of his people. It is you who have devoured the vineyard. The plunder of the poor is in your houses. What do you mean by crushing my people and grinding the face of the poor, declares the Lord God of hosts. So God arises. This is the second time that it's mentioned that, and in both times it indicates God moving to action of judgment. He's kind of rousing. The image I get is God has been quiet and sitting back, patiently waiting. But the time comes when he gets up to take action, and that's this kind of situation. And he stands to judge the people. And who is he going to judge here? Who's picked out? Who's singled out for his judgment? It's the rulers. And we've noticed on two or three occasions already in Isaiah, he has singled out the rulers for special attention because they have been rebellious. They have been taking advantage of their power, and they have been especially taking advantage of the powerless in their midst. And they've been enriching themselves at their expense. So God is going to judge this leadership that has been irresponsible. He says, it is you who have devoured the vineyard. That image of the vineyard is going to come up in the next chapter. And it's a very powerful image in the next chapter. It's expanded upon. But the vineyard is the nation of Israel. And this vineyard is one that God has planted. He set up. He prepared it. And the vineyard has been plundered by its leaders, is what's being suggested here. It's been devoured by its leaders. Rather than appreciating what God has done, they've taken advantage of their situation. He says, the plunder of the poor is in your houses. So they have just been taking advantage of people. He goes on to say, what do you mean by crushing my people and grinding the face of the poor? God is identifying with those people in the society of Israel who are least capable of defending themselves. That's what he means by my people here, is those who can't defend themselves. Then it says, declares the Lord God of hosts. And usually when it uses the phrase God of hosts, the hosts are the armies. So the God of hosts is the God militant. He's armed and ready to go. He's ready to take action. That's the God that's speaking here. Okay, now it's going to change rather abruptly. We'll have to try to figure out why so, starting in verse 16. Moreover, the Lord said, because the daughters of Zion are proud and walk with heads held high and seductive eyes and go along with mincing steps and tinkle the bangles on their feet, therefore the Lord will afflict the scalp of the daughters of Zion with scabs, and the Lord will make their foreheads bare. In that day, the Lord will take away the beauty of their anklets, headbands, crescent ornaments, dangling earrings, bracelets, veils, headdresses, ankle chains, sashes, perfume boxes, amulets, finger rings, nose rings, festal robes, outer tunics, cloaks, money purses, hand mirrors, undergarments, turbans, and veils. Now it will come about that instead of sweet perfume, there will be putrefaction. Instead of a belt, a rope. Instead of well-set hair, a plucked-out scalp. Instead of fine clothes, a donning of sackcloth. And branding instead of beauty. Your men will fall by the sword, and your mighty ones in battle. And her gates will lament and mourn, and deserted she will sit on the ground. Why in the text at this particular point does it turn and address, speak with respect to the daughters of Zion, the women in Jerusalem? My suspicion is that this is just a continuation of God's condemnation of the rulers. I think primarily what's in mind here, what's in view here, are the wives and daughters of those rulers. Because it goes into great length talking about all the things that they have, which leads you to believe that they are well off, which leads one to believe that they are connected with those rulers that have been condemned just in the verses before that. So I suspect that that's what's going on here. This is condemnation not just of the men rulers, but their families as well, that whole social strata of society in Jerusalem that has gained its wealth at the expense of the poor and the powerless. It talks about the daughters of Zion being proud once again. We've seen that theme coming up before. They walk with their heads held high and seductive eyes and go along with mincing steps and tinkle the bangles of their feet. You get the idea that these are women who are flirtatious, seductive eyes. So there's a flirtatiousness about them, not faithful to their commitments in marriage. As a result of this, their judgment is coming. It says that the Lord will afflict the scalp of the daughters of Zion with scabs, and the Lord will make their foreheads bare. So their disease apparently will come, and presumably that's related to the fact that the food and water has been cut off to Jerusalem, poor nutrition. I suspect all of that's related. They will lose their hair. Verses 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, and 23 is all a list of the ornaments that they have used to adorn their bodies, that will all be taken away in that day. And we've seen "in that day" used before. And it seems to be the time when God moves in judgment. It was used a couple of times in chapter 2. Then verse 24, it talks about the transformation that they will undergo, that the things that they had and that they delighted in, they took pride in, are going to be turned on them. So their sweet perfume will be replaced with a stench. Their belt will be replaced with a rope. Their well-set hair will be replaced with a plucked-out scalp. Their fine clothes will be replaced with sackcloth. And their beauty will be replaced with a branding. So the things that will replace their ornamentation, the things that they were proud of, will all be indications of their humiliation. And they are all indications of mourning, of defeat and loss. And the last one, the branding, suggests maybe even enslavement. So that's the judgment that they will suffer as a result of their arrogance. Then the last two verses, it switches to "your men will fall by the sword." The "your" here is singular and apparently refers to Jerusalem, the city of Jerusalem. So Jerusalem's men will fall by the sword, and Jerusalem's mighty ones in battle. Jerusalem's gates will lament and mourn, and deserted, Jerusalem will sit on the ground. So it's using an image of Jerusalem being this woman who has been left desolate, that the men of the city have been defeated in battle. All of her warriors, all of her generals, all the soldiers have been killed in battle. There's nothing happening in her gates, and the gates of the old cities were that was the city hall, that was city center. That's where all government took place. That's where economic, financial matters took place. And so that's generally the life of the city. The life of the city will be gone. There will just be lament and mourning. And deserted, she will sit on the ground, left alone, nothing there. Now, I think verse 1 of chapter 4 should go with this section. Let me read it. "For seven women will take hold of one man in that day, saying, 'We will eat our own bread and wear our own clothes. Only let us be called by your name. Take away our reproach.'" I think this is indicating a situation of dire need, one in which probably most of the men of the city have been killed in battle. So you have many women who are newly widowed. And in that time and culture, to have a husband to take care of you was very important. There's going to be such desperation that seven women will grab one man and want to be in a marriage relationship with that one man in order to have that kind of care and protection. They say, we'll even bring our own bread. We'll wear our own clothes. You don't have to provide that. Only let us be called by your name. Take away our reproach. So it's talking about a situation in which things are very dire, and people are desperate for sources of security and safety. Okay, as I piece this together then, I think what's happening here is a description of Jerusalem being besieged. And it's a time in which Jerusalem is besieged. The food and water are cut off, so they can't That's the goal of a siege, is to wear down a city by cutting off all of its supplies so that it becomes desperate and so that it gives up without having to engage it with a pitched battle. So Jerusalem is being besieged, no food and water, a potent enemy just outside the walls. A crisis ensues inside the city, as is easily imaginable. And in that situation of crisis, the leadership is overthrown. There are probably myriads of people vying for some position of leadership or just taking advantage of the vacuum of leadership. And as time goes on, they're desperate for anyone who can restore order. And the women, the wives and the children of the ruling, what had been the wealthy and ruling class, they are humiliated. They're put in a situation where they are mourning the loss of all the men, including their husbands, and probably reduced to a position of slavery and taken away from the city. When would this be describing? The historical situation that fits most neatly would be when the Babylonians come. When the Babylonians come, they besiege Jerusalem, and they are able to take the city. They sack the city, and they take a large number of the population that remains away to Babylon in exile. So I suspect that's ultimately what it's talking about. Just a couple of concluding remarks. This description of the women in the last part of the chapter could be kind of a depiction of Jerusalem and the Israelites themselves. That the people of Israel have conducted themselves very arrogantly, and the people of Israel have been flirtatious, that is to say, have been disloyal to their God and in the market for other protectors. So this could be kind of an image of Jerusalem and Israel itself. I'm not sure. Okay, so that's the judgment that comes on Israel as a result of Israel's arrogance, its refusal to acknowledge the care and provision that God has provided over a long period of time for them, and as a result, they're giving themselves over to idolatry, as I've described idolatry earlier. Okay, I'm going to open it up for questions and comments.
Thank you very much, David. Mm-hmm. Early on, mm-hmm. You mentioned in talking about your conviction about biblical inspiration and inerrancy that over the years that's been how you've understood that has modified a bit, and that 30 years ago, some of the things that you think now you might have thought.
Right.
I think you said heresy. I presume you mean a violation of biblical inspiration,
yeah,
or something like that.
Yeah.
Would you mind giving an example or two of what you mean? I think I kind of know, but mm-hmm. I wonder if you could mm-hmm. mention it. Either a Bible passage or two, or else just the idea, the principle.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
Well, here's the kind of thing I'm thinking about. I remember years ago reading a book by Harold Lindzell, The Battle for the Bible,
right,
in which he was taking on people that were taking stands that seemed to be undermining the authority of the Bible and the concept of inerrancy. And at the time that I read it, I was thinking, yeah, that's... he's dead on. That's really the problem. And now I thumbed through that book a couple of years ago, and I was thinking, I'm not sure that I agree with everything that he's saying here. And here are a couple of examples. One of them is the question of, if it's inspired, does it have to be exact? That is to say, if the Bible says that there were 300,000 people killed in a battle, does that mean that if we went out and counted the bodies and it was 299,999 bodies, that would be an error? And I think previously I would have said, yeah, because it was 300,000, because 299,999 rather than 300,000. But as I've reflected more on how language works, if you say 300,000, oftentimes you're just saying in the ballpark of. You don't intend it to be not one more and not one less.
You mean when the sports guys say there were 58,000 fans at the Duck football game, they're not being inerrant if there was 58,001.
Right.
Is that the idea?
Right.
So approximation.
So it's that kind of thing. Another one that I've been thinking about recently is, if in Matthew, in the Sermon on the Mount, are those, what's recorded there by Matthew, are those the words that Jesus actually spoke? And 30 years ago, I would have said, yes, those are the words that Jesus spoke. Now I'm to this point where I'm not certain that those are the words that Jesus spoke. First of all, Jesus was probably speaking Aramaic rather than Greek. But even aside from that, is it not possible that Matthew would record a version of what Jesus said that is faithful to what he said, but not the exact words that he used? I think that's possible. So it's things like that where I'm kind of thinking about and making some adjustments in the way that I understand inerrancy. But I am committed. I really do believe that the Bible is inerrant in what the author wrote and inspired.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, David, I had two questions, and Dave just asked the first one.
Okay.
But maybe just add one thing to that. And what exactly do you mean when you say that the Bible is inspired and inerrant?
Well, what I believe to be the case, I don't know exactly how it happened, but what I believe to be the case is that God worked through the lives of the authors to produce the works that were produced in exactly the form that God wanted them to be produced. Now, I don't believe in a dictation form of inspiration where God said, write down, Moses, in the beginning. I don't believe a dictation form of inspiration. I don't know exactly how it happened, but what we see in the writing seems to be a reflection of the character of the human author. So what God seems to have done is worked through the life of that author in such a way that he prepared them to write that work the way it was written and worked through that process to guarantee that that's what happened. So I believe that it was that the words that are there are the ones that God intended to have recorded for us, at least in the original manuscript. And therefore, it's trustworthy.
Okay.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, yeah. And then my other question was, when you were talking about the Jews, some were righteous, and the ones, it didn't seem like others were terribly bad. I mean, they weren't blatant.
Mm-hmm.
What exactly, can you elaborate on that? I mean, what would that look like? Not just during when Isaiah was written, but what that would look like today.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I guess because what's in the back of my mind is the idea that not all Christians are going to be, all people that call themselves Christians will be saved.
Yeah. I think what he's referring to is the spirit of individuals within Israel, that there are some that have a righteous spirit and there are some who have a wicked spirit. And I do not find it difficult to identify with those with a wicked spirit, because the wicked spirit in me wells up too often, and I identify with it very easily. And it doesn't necessarily work its way out in blatant and outrageous evil, but it's just a spirit of, I want it my way, God. And that can be cloaked in religiosity. It can be cloaked all kinds of different ways. But it's not the spirit of, let thy will be done. Not my will, but thy will be done. That's the righteous spirit. The spirit of a rebel is, I don't want this to happen. I do want this other thing to happen. What do I need to do to manipulate you to get that to come about? And that's the spirit of a rebel. So what I think, that it's very easy for a whole society to have the spirit of a rebel, there be no outrageous evil in the midst. I mean, there will be a few poor people that are taken advantage of and that sort of thing, but not outrageous evil. But nevertheless, the whole society is characterized by that kind of rebelliousness. All cloaked, and it can all be cloaked in religiosity, and that seems to be the case here in Isaiah.
This is another question about inerrancy and how it relates to prophecy in particular.
Mm-hmm.
I've been wondering for a while how much the writings and the prophets are grounded in the cultural context that they were written out of. For instance, the passage you read today about the gates will be empty. Mm-hmm. And at the time, all of the commerce and political activity, there's a lot of that that is symbolized in the gates being empty.
Right.
That maybe, so in the future, what he's prophesying, is he saying all of that activity is going to be dead and silenced, regardless of whether at the time he's prophesying that still takes place in the gates?
Mm-hmm.
Or is he actually saying, no, the gates are going to be empty? So yeah, I guess just to what extent do you understand the inerrancy as being something that's being communicated to a certain context in which it was written that may not be true at the time that it takes place?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not sure that I would call that a question of inerrancy. An issue of inerrancy as much as it is an issue of how do we understand the nature of the prophecy. Is the prophecy being presented in symbolic terms, or is it being presented in terms of actual matter of fact? And I think with a lot of these, it is very difficult to tell because it's kind of couched in a way that looks symbolic. And I'm inclined to take it as symbolic in this particular instance. However, it probably is also true that the gates were emptied of all business and governmental affairs at the time when Jerusalem was at the peak of the siege. So it kind of slops over from one to the other. But I think it's actually being presented as more symbolic than as a description of the actual facts of the matter. But that, with prophecy, that's a really difficult decision. Any other questions?
I'm looking at the, I guess it's the first verse on 4, the one that ends, yes, with take away our disgrace. And I can think of two kinds of disgrace that they could be referring to, either that culturally it is simply disgraceful to be unattached to a man, or that in because, or scenario two, that because they are detached from a protector, they are being, they're the subjects of lewd remarks or propositioning or that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Do you have any sense which is happening here? I guess if it's the first one, then it's a cultural thing that I'm just much less familiar with, whereas the second one I could certainly imagine.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised, but what the two are connected, that I'm assuming that it is that they are without a husband, that that's the primary problem, and someone to care for them and protect them. But it's not hard to imagine that the second kind would tag along with that as well. And that adds to the pressure, that adds to the difficulty. But I'm inclined to think that it's the first is what's primarily in mind here.
To your knowledge, is anything in this chapter quoted later on?
In the New Testament? Are you thinking about?
Yes.
Let me go through the New Testament. I don't know. I don't know. Yes, but that the next chapter, yes, that concept of the vineyard is going to come up again. An actual quotation I'm not aware of, but that vineyard image is going to be developed much more in the next chapter. But to answer your question, I don't know. Anything else?
I was thinking about the man who declined leadership, and I think that he realized that he didn't have what it took to care for himself, much less for anyone else. And then
that could very well be
when you were talking about how the evil in Israel couldn't be very blatant. I thought of what it would look like if Isaiah was talking to blatant evil. And I realized that he would have brought up more concrete examples than just, oh, the women and the orphans aren't being taken care of.
That's my thinking, is that if it was outrageous evil, he could just say, look at this happening. And everybody would recognize, that's a violation of the law. But I think we're looking at something more subtle.
With the women and all the decorations and so on. And then I think there's two more aspects to that. I think like addressing the women is like, okay, you're not involved in the money making, you're not involved in all these things, but you're still complicit in this because you're going along with this. Mm-hmm. You're saying, you know, this is okay, you're benefiting from this.
Yes.
And the second thing I think is it addresses, particularly at that time, the strengths women had. In other words, if a woman was beauty, she could, very beautiful, she could cross over from, say, one social class into another because of that. And a man could do the same if he was particularly skillful or strong, also cross over. So I think that's also part of that.
Okay, thanks. Anything else? Okay, thanks.